We saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And all we do is get hit on like we're terrible. And what we've done with the ventilators and with the medical equipment and with testing, you know, testing is a double-edged sword. We've tested now 25 million people. It's probably 20 million people more than anybody else. Germany's done a lot. South Korea's done a lot. He called me. They said, the job you're doing, here's the bad part. When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
That was President Donald Trump talking about America's coronavirus response at a Saturday rally in Tulsa. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first summer 2020 edition of the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hey, kids.
Howdy.
How's it going?
Hey, Matt.
It's going great, Peter. Thank you for asking. So last week we did a really bang up job in not talking about either coronavirus or Donald Trump. So I figured let's just knock this right off at the top here. Let's go to what we used to do often, which is the grisly bullet points. We've got 120,000 or so COVID deaths in the United States, which is about one quarter of the world's total. New York, which has taken an outsized role in the national imagination about all this stuff, continues to improve very rapidly. My local playground is going to open up here at the end of this podcast, and it makes me really excited. But meanwhile, it's warm weather or hot weather states like Arizona and Texas that are seeing spikes in incidences and also in lethality. As people scurry back indoors. Overall, fatality rates, however, nationally are dropping. Meanwhile, people continue to kind of retreat into their culture war roles, teams, trenches, something on the issues of mass gatherings, on wearing masks, and of course, the great June 2020 fireworks conspiracy. It's all very confusing, Peter. Since you write about health policy, can you try to make some sense out of where we are right now as a nation when it comes to coronavirus and related policies and mitigations?
Where we are is 3 months in, and we have had enough of the coronavirus, but the coronavirus has not had enough of us. The economy is reopening. I mean, here in Washington, D.C., we are entering phase two today. So that means that restaurants can start serving people inside at 50% capacity. It means that gyms can reopen. However, you have to have a reservation and there are capacity limits. In theory, you're supposed to wear a mask. I'm not quite sure how that works in the locker room, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happening. And New York is has a new phase of reopening today. There are people being allowed back into offices for the first time. Some public parks are reopening. So the economy is coming back online, but the virus hasn't gone away. Instead, we've kind of given up on efforts to beat it. And so as a result, what we're seeing are a spike in number of cases, new cases nationally. So cases are up from a low of around 20,000 new cases per day a couple weeks ago to about 23,500. That's still lower than it was in April. The interesting thing to go along with that, though, is that even as cases are spiking back up, deaths are continuing to go down. And so that's deaths per day, right? And one reason why is because the new cases are concentrated in young people, especially in southern states. We've had a bunch of outbreaks that have been traced to things like bars and frat parties, stuff like that. Some of the new mitigation efforts that are going online, stuff like New York's contact tracing program, just aren't working so well. They're not hitting their goals there, in part because they have a relatively low-paid staff that is being asked to do what is essentially investigative journalism. You get somebody's name, and then what you have to do is find out who that person was around and who that person talked to for the last 3 or 4 days or week. And then you have to call all of those people and interview them. You don't have to write a feature at the end of it, but this is basically what journalists do when they're tracking down a story. And that's a hard thing to train people to do very quickly, which is what they're trying to do. In terms of...
I think it's pretty easy to actually train people not to turn in a long story at the end of several weeks.
Yes, that part is easy.
It takes years to get it just right.
That's the natural...
one other indicator that is interesting that we should probably note is that, just in case people are sort of tempted to think that, well, this isn't really a real thing, it's mostly a media creation, if you go look at Southern states, Apple, which has an incentive to be open, is actually closing stores. And so we don't have the Waffle House Index, which for Southerners you may be familiar with, because Waffle House is pretty much the last thing to close when there are hurricanes. And so growing up in Florida, you would figure out how bad a hurricane was by which Waffle Houses remained open where. And so, but now we have the Apple Index, and that is going to tell us, basically, they've got a huge amount of money on the line, and they've got, you know, they would like to get to have those sales. And so if they're closing, there's a reason for it. And that reason is that cases are getting worse in the South. The other thing that I would just say, and you referenced this a little bit, is that politically, this has turned into an absolute minefield. And this is maybe the thing that worries me most in the long term, is that we've just failed as a country to avoid turning this into a pure culture war issue, where your political outlook determines basically how you think and how you respond to the virus. And both left and right have just completely embarrassed themselves here, with the left saying for months, oh my gosh, if you even go outside and walk your dog, you're probably going to die. But now there's a protest exemption where you can gather with 10,000 people screaming for a couple of hours. And then the right saying, oh my goodness, this is just a hoax to defeat Trump and destroy the economy. It's not real at all. And it's really, I think, a bad sign for America politically, how we've dealt with this and how people are deciding to talk about it right now.
Thank you for that thorough breakdown, Peter Suderman. Catherine, lucky for you, you do not live in a household, as far as I know, that thrills on a daily basis to the press conference stylings of LoveGov Andrew Cuomo. So you might not realize that he had his final one, his final daily coronavirus briefing on Friday, which, and I'm not making this up, came amidst a background of like emotional piano playing, like the wailing strings, talking about all of the stuff that we've learned here and the journey along the way, and you know what this all means for humanity, and this kind of stuff. Is one thing that we have learned along the way that journalists and commentators are especially gullible to politicians and other leaders who can put sentences together, even though there are dead bodies piling up all around them.
Matt, are you saying that the real virus was the friends we made along the way?
I'm getting there.
You kinda walked right up to that. I don't know if you want to cross that line.
Yeah.
I mean, the desperate desire by human beings to have someone to follow and look up to in times of crisis is a serious force to be reckoned with. The fact that we don't have that, at least people on the left don't have that in our president at the moment, means that people go looking elsewhere, and God help them if the place they find it is a Cuomo, really any Cuomo, but especially Governor Cuomo. The self-aggrandizement of those briefings got kind of more and more impressive each day, to my mind. I would say I did not watch them regularly, but because they were such a weird cultural phenomenon, I dipped in and watched them periodically. And I actually would love to see a kind of side-by-side comparison of the first couple of those, where there was kind of a genuine, straightforward effort to do some crisis management and communicate with people about what was and wasn't safe. By the end, it was, as you say, like swelling violins and, you know, wow, we really worked together.
Puppet shows.
We worked together to beat this thing.
I like
the slow motion
doves the best.
I mean, it was like a telethon that ran out of celebrities after like 5 minutes.
And there is, I would say there's a lot going on in white lady social media these days, like a lot. As a white lady on social media, I am at the very least observing.
What do you mean?
Observing,
what do you mean by
so
that?
Obviously the like 14 layers of white lady participation, guilt about incorrect participation, re-participation in like graphic design will save us from racism. Instagram is like a real situation. The reading list sharing, all of that. So there's Black Lives Matter, White Lady Instagram, but a subcurrent in my Instagram and Twitter and other white lady platforms has been the Cuomo love, like just a really deep affection for Cuomo wow. that I simply don't share, but must at least anecdotally document sociologically as a phenomenon. And I'm glad, I guess, that this chapter of Cuomo is over, even though another one is beginning.
Is he going to end up with one of those America's Sexiest Man awards?
Yes, he is. It's going to be like Fauci and Cuomo on the cover of People magazine.
Gavin Newsom.
Oh, yeah.
And the Hollywood, the matinee idol looks of the former San Francisco
mayor. I mean, in general, I do think there should be a broad-based prohibition on giving those Sexiest Man awards ever to someone in politics. Like, let's just avoid that flat out. But if we must, at least not Cuomo.
You know, we tried that with Dennis Hassert to go with the sexlessiest man in politics. But, and that didn't work out.
It's
the return of the repressed.
To return to the slightly more serious point, people really, really did and do want someone to just tell them what to do. And I think coronavirus in particular was striking because we didn't know what to do. And we still a little bit don't know what to do. And the desire to be told what to do didn't go away, even though we just didn't have answers to that question. And it reminds me of my children who get mad when they want a black and white answer to a complicated question. Not that I'm comparing to the American people to children, but I definitely am.
Let's try to take.
I think even more disturbing, Catherine, you were comparing yourself to Andrew Cuomo in that analogy.
True.
Let's try to keep our children hatred to just a dull boil. It's not going to be possible.
No can do, Fred.
Let's just have it sublimated, seething right below the surface. A lot of S's there. Nick, I know you want to bash the Cuomos, but let's talk about another irritating politician.
I love the Cuomos, especially Mario Cuomo. He can't hurt us anymore, Matt.
Mario Cuomo.
All I got to tell the listening audience, besides that we love you and I love you in particular, is that you are missing on, speaking of Italian Americans, one hell of a haircut from Nick Gillespie. Jesus.
It's swoopy.
It is beautiful.
It is really frustrating because I haven't had this haircut since the Carter administration. Yeah.
Just for those who can't see, I want to briefly sum up: Matt floppy, Nick swoopy, Peter alarming.
Peter's got a late mid career Andy Garcia vibe right now. Nick, I'm
that's really insulting.
Yeah, it is. And Nick has got he would be in All the President's Men, except he's a little bit too old kind of thing.
Ouch. Yeah. Wow.
No, I mean, they're
way too old. No, because Woodward and Bernstein were junior high.
They were
or something
cub reporters, Nick.
Yeah. We don't have that anymore, Matt. We're too busy with our fancy degrees and courses and political correctness.
I won't say anything about Catherine because she has.
The cub reporters work for contact tracing in New York now.
That's true.
Or Condé Nast, and they walk out when they are given Strunken Whites, The Elements of Style, which anybody anywhere who puts that book down, I'm with
them.
Have
Strunken White been canceled?
Oh, you didn't hear that one. That was a thing.
There
was a microaggression that was reported. Was it by a New York Times reporter, Nick?
No, I think it was Vanity Fair.
I did miss that.
Was it Bon Appetit, actually?
An older editor type put down a Strunken White. And this, for normies out there, this is just like there's two or three books that every journalist will have at some point in their life. One is an AP style guide. One is Strunken White. And there's a rule of three. I don't know what the third.
The elements of style.
Right. And so this was seen as a microaggression because recipient took it as you people don't really understand good grammar or something.
Well, it was a woman of color who was a personal assistant to an editor in chief. Was it Bon Appetit? Something like that. But
at any rate.
Yeah, so Strunken White, they were canceled.
Nick, you have written and spoken previously prior to all of this madness, and I don't know when that would be, but you've spoken with some appreciation of President Trump's kind of comedy stylings and timing.
Oh, yeah.
Does it, after listening to this clip and listening to whatever filtered stuff that you got from his performance in Tulsa over the weekend, does it ring differently to your ears and therefore America's ears, since you are America?
Yeah. I am America's ear.
Covered with beautiful hair.
Yeah. No, I wear my hair over my ears because my ears are large and jug-shaped, I believe, as my parents would lovingly tell me.
Does it sound different 3 months into this like relentless trauma that we've been living through?
You know, about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, I wrote a piece that was the most popular piece I've ever written online, saying Trump had kind of secured the election when he gave this bravura stemwinder at CPAC, making fun of the Green New Deal and talking about how he wants to run against the Green New Deal and the train to Hawaii. He's looking forward to taking the train to Hawaii. It was kind of a great, performance. I think a year later, if that was his deer hunter, what we saw in Tulsa was his Heaven's Gate. Peter, at least, will appreciate that. This was a bloated, overlong, underdeveloped showpiece that was really boring. I was talking to Catherine before we started, and as a parent, I had this experience of falling asleep during Pirates of the Caribbean 3 and Spider-Man 3 and getting like an hour's worth of sleep, waking up, realizing I'm in the same movie and thinking I'm dreaming because nothing could be this long and this boring. Trump's talk was not good in Tulsa. And it's clear he's wearing thin, poll wise, he's down from where he was and he was never that popular. But even among Republicans, his enthusiasm is dipping a little bit. He needs a better shtick. He needs a more positive shtick, which is one of the things that he did a year ago. And at various points, you see this where he gives up on the absolute attack animus. And he actually gives a little bit of food, a little bit of sustenance. He did that towards the very end of the Tulsa speech, but it was far too little, spread over too long. And I think he needs to, he needs free advice, right? But he needs to actually have a positive agenda rather than a relentlessly negative one. He, as with running against Hillary Clinton, he's blessed by the fact that he's running against Joe Biden, who, most of the time can't make it out up the staircase in his basement to get out and talk to people, which is probably good for Joe Biden because when he talks for more than 5 minutes with anybody, he starts talking about, just crazy stuff about like, you always make sure that you marry somebody with 5 sisters because one of them will love you, man. if you scroll through Joe Biden's recent sightings, he's demented. I think literally demented. But one of these guys is going to be president of the United States. And so the American experiment, a fail.
Hey, can I actually want to ask. So you said a thing which is like a classic. Matt can't recover from the kicker from Nick there. You said a classic thing that's like a pundit line for the ages, which is like they need a positive agenda, right? That people want a positive agenda. Yeah. Is that true? Like at all? Anymore. Like, not to come out here Monday morning full of darkness, but I am no longer convinced that anybody out there is demanding with their vote or with their polling responses an actual positive agenda.
I would argue, and you can push it too far, but, when you look at people like Ronald Reagan, when you look at people like Bill Clinton, when you look at Barack Obama, when you look at George W. Bush, particularly in 2000 against Al Gore, who was kind of playing defense. Yeah, people in a president especially, they want somebody who can be acid-tongued and nasty and mean, and you want, they respond to people being negative about their opponents, but they also do want a vision of a world in which you can work for a living, you can go outside, you can, you're not going to be, playing among the ashes of, a nuclear incineration. And
you can go outside, Trump 2020. Yeah.
I mean, that would but be, also, like, that's did a positive you just, bell, man. Right now, did you just and, offer the Daisy ad as a positive vision? Like, again, I'm not.
Yeah, but what's great about the Daisy ad was that it ran once and then got all of this, earned media, because of the discussion about it. Barry Goldwater was so far behind. Most of what LBJ was doing in 1964, he was promoing the Great Society. relentlessly. And if you look at his ads, he was even in the Daisy ad, he talks about we have to love each other. He was the love gov in, you know, in 1964. And he won with the greatest smackdown and, you know, up to that point in presidential history. So I do think, and I, you know, I really regret the reality that either Trump or Biden is going to be president, but one of them giving some kind of like believable, you know, promise of a better future, which, by the way, the baseline is pretty low. All you have to do is, you know, is say like, hey, you're going to be able to go outside, you know, on odd and even number days based on your license plate or something. And people will be like, okay, that's a positive agenda for the next 4 years.
I think, Catherine, one way to look at it is that at least if you look at history of the last, let's say, of Nick's lifetime.
So the last thousand
years. it just toggles, yeah. Right? Like you have the positives, the sunny side up guys, the Nixon, Nick.
Yeah. Whoa, paging Dr. Freud.
Nick mentioned, and that would include JFK too in that list, right? And then you have the kind of cramped reaction guys, and that's Nixon, right? Jimmy Carter was kind of a sour continent.
Well, in 76, though, Carter was kind of positive. He was the outsider who was going to clean it up after.
It was a cleansing, he quickly.
But in 80, yeah, he was Mr. Malaise. You know, he was like, we're hunkered down.
And oftentimes I think right now we're definitely in it. You know, the American Carnage president has a sour thing. Although even there, like the kind of one of the allures of him is that he's fun from the perspective of his supporters, the dwindling number of people who will show up at his rallies and stuff, like it's part of the fun. But anyways, I think it goes back and forth. But enough about me. Let's talk about statues. For crying out loud, the statue wars that are gripping America, because why the hell not? Over the weekend, the Museum of Natural History in New York City announced that it would be taking down its iconic outdoor statue of Teddy Roosevelt, which, if you haven't been there, yes, it is of Teddy Roosevelt on a horse, but then there's like... There's like this guy, this Native American with the big head feathers on one side, and then there's like black guy with his shirt off next to him, and it's pretty weird statue, I always thought. Anyways, they've taken it down partly at the behest of Teddy Roosevelt IV.
Have they actually taken it down already, or they're planning to?
Sorry about that. They announced they're going to do that. But anyways, that has sent a lot of people into a commentary because this comes in the wake of a whole number of statues that are either being taken down by mobs or by museums or being defaced, and a short list, and this is all kind of in the wake of the George Floyd protests, a short list would include in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, we had defenestrations of Father Junipero Serra, Francis Scott Key, Star Spangled Banner anthem writer, so Nick probably likes that because he hates that song, and
Slave owner,
and President Ulysses Grant. Also, it's a curious choice. Also defaced in that particular purge was Miguel de Cervantes, which is a very strange thing to do. In the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, a statue of George Washington was pulled down, its head set on fire, and its body tagged by spray paint with 1619 in reference to the so-named New York Times project when a columnist from the New York Post said, let's call these the 1619 riots. The head of the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones, tweeted, it would be an honor. Thank you. So a lot of places to go with this. Peter, I want to start with you since you haven't talked for a while, and I called you Andy Garcia. I have heard the following argument that I would like you to respond to in any way that you choose, which is that, hey, you people didn't pay attention to us when we protested peacefully. You people didn't pay attention to us when we petitioned the government for redress and changing of their policies. You only pay attention to us now when we deface your statues, so we're coming after your statues. What say you, Peter Suderman?
Well, that argument is an argument that attempts to work at the level of both abstract and physical symbol, right? And that's what these statues are, is that they are symbols of our politics, of our history, of our self-conception. And, you know, in some ways, that's fairly normal for politics. Politics often kind of invariably works at the level of symbol. It's sort of unavoidable. And symbols certainly have a power that, you know, think tank panels and model legislation and all the other kind of nerdy stuff that gets done in the world of politics just doesn't. But the statue stuff, at least in terms of when it is when it's crowds deciding to do that rather than administrators, rather than folks who are sort of in charge of cities. But even to some extent, when it's the folks who are in charge, it is an attempt in some ways to sort of, I think, to rewrite America's history and an attempt to reshape America's self-conception in the process. And almost independent of whether you agree with that goal, it's so grand and so sweeping and also so vague in some ways that I think it is likely to struggle, especially if it doesn't also focus on substantive policy change. And, you know, I would offer as a counterpoint, if you look at Black Lives Matter over the past couple of years, I think it has been most successful not as an all-encompassing rewriting of national history, though there has been some of that, and certainly Black Lives Matter has worked at the level of symbol and of sort of narrative, but it has worked best, I think, as a very specific critique of police violence and police brutality and the disparate impact that violence has on people of color. BLM has put together packages of police reforms, big picture ideas, but also pretty granular local policy changes. If you look right now, Black Lives Matter activists are working with the Dayton police and with Dayton authorities to push forward reforms. And the stuff that they're doing, some of it is pretty big picture, but like some of it is, you know, is like they want to dismantle the shot spotter program. They want to reestablish the five districts police model. They also want to establish a reparations program. But even that reparations program, if you actually listen to what the activists are saying, it's much more in the sort of reasonable realm of politics as we know it than you might think, because what they're actually saying is we spend a ton of money on criminal justice programs, on locking people up. What if instead we use that money to incentivize minority business owners in Dayton? And this is Dayton. It's not New York City. It's not San Francisco. It's not Chicago. It's not one of these sort of giant megalopolises. It's just a really ordinary middle of the country American city. And Black Lives Matter activists are actually working in a kind of small and granular way to affect systemic change. And that is what works. And I think that, you know, in some ways, I think the sort of the statue thing distracts us from that. It distracts the people who want change from those sorts of from that sort of work in some ways, because that is as unsexy and as unlikely as it is to become part of a presidential speech, as unlikely as it is to, the, you know, those reforms are not making CNN every day. But they are much more likely, I think, to make a real substantive difference in people's lives. And I would just encourage activists, whatever it is that you want to do, whether it's reform the police, whether it's change America's sort of sense of how it, of just sense of itself and how race plays into our founding and our history and what we should do about that. Focus on those little small reforms, on making those substantive changes, because policy reform is what matters right now and is what is actually going to matter in people's lives going forward.
Catherine, you did sailing at Yale. I saw over the weekend that your good friend Ann Coulter was agitating to rename Yale University because it was founded for some kind of by some kind of slaver. I don't know. I wouldn't. Yale. What say you to Ann Coulter's modest proposal?
It is not Ann Coulter's proposal. It was Jesse Kelly's modest proposal.
Oh!
So just to...
Is that
you
better
identify
or
him
worse?
For listeners who are not deep in the bench of right-wing nut jobs?
You've done the ID, the brief ID for me there, Nick. So Jesse Kelly does a tweet which was explicitly meant to mock cancel culture. It was, Yale University was named for Elihu Yale, not a man who had slaves, an actual slave trader. I call on Yale to change its name immediately and strip the name of Yale from every building, piece of paper, and merchandise. Otherwise, they hate black people. Hashtag cancel Yale. And then that started trending. And, you know, I hate to acknowledge when a troll really comes together like this, but wow. Because
so do you agree with that, though, or should should Yale consider
the question
renaming
the question was asked there?
Yeah. Right. So I think it is. I understand why people are struggling with this question right now. I genuinely do. But the answer cannot be we must prioritize taking the names of everyone who ever owned a slave off of everything forever and ever. Amen. And I get that that's a, you know, that sounds like a callous thing to say, but hi, here I am. And I think, you know, Yale, for instance, has already renamed at least one of its residential colleges, one of the dorms on campus, because it was named after John C. Calhoun. And so there isn't a sort of an extent to which we're doing the we've already established what you are, madam. We're just negotiating the price at this point. Like once we've said, listen, it's disqualifying to be strongly associated in the popular understanding of history with slavery, for instance, which might be one way to characterize the criteria for renaming. Jesse Kelly has a point. There is no difference between something, you know, named after a former slave trader or a slave owner, just because that's a longstanding name doesn't mean it has any special power over us. And we should cancel everything. Obviously, his point is to illustrate, like, we should also not rename everything named after Christopher Columbus. We should also not rename everything named after George Washington. We should also not.
Oh, we've got to rename Columbus, Ohio, Flavortown.
I mean,
that's got to happen. There is a petition to do this. It's Guy Fieri's hometown. He's a great son of Ohio. Why not rename it Flavortown?
While we're at it, should we just officially rename DC Chocolate City? Like, are we going to do that?
Wow. Only if it's in reference to Daryl Dawkins.
Columbus is the headquarters of several fast food chains, including White Castle and Wendy's. So it is, in fact, Flavortown.
Columbia is a pre-existing thing. So maybe we can just retcon the genealogy of some of these names. But so anyway, this becomes a huge trending thing. Jesse Kelly just like leans all the way in to the hashtag. People are losing their minds. Most people do not seem to know the origin of this. They're like, yeah, definitely do cancel. And we're going to see a lot more of this because it's true. You can cancel basically every historical figure. And I would be perfectly happy to see every darn thing in the world named after Zora Neale Hurston. But I don't think that
she was problematic after about 1948 or so.
But this is what I'm talking about when I say that, you know, operating entirely at the level of symbol is in some sense satisfying for certain people. It
right.
It gets people's attention. People will talk about it. But let's say we renamed everything named after every American founder, got rid of all the Confederate statues, and also renamed everything that had the word Yale on it with, I don't know, whatever else, with something else. Would that make more or less difference than enacting a half dozen of the 10 police reforms in Dayton? I think the Dayton folks are actually much more likely to make real differences in people's lives. And that's where people, like, again, whatever your sort of political project is, those sorts of things are just much less sexy. They're much less interesting to talk about and sort of, right? They don't have the kind of super controversial edge to them. They're not trolls. What they are attempts to modestly but meaningfully change people's lives for the better.
To play devil's advocate,
but you're asking, you're acting as if these are mutually exclusive.
Again, I didn't say they were exclusive, but what and in fact, I said politics always operates at the level of symbol to some extent. Black Lives Matter activists have certainly operated at the level of symbol in a lot of ways. But then what they have done is convert that into specific policy reforms for the police in ways that I think are in many ways, I don't agree with all of it, but in many, many ways, quite productive.
But, you know, so for instance, we're also talking about something different, a public statuary and say colleges, Georgetown, which was the first Catholic university in the United States, what used slave labor in order to build it. A couple of years ago, they went through, you know, a kind of public reckoning of that, which is totally symbolic because all the people involved are dead, but also meaningful. And supposedly, and this is a big supposedly, they put in policies to increase African-American representation on campus and throughout faculty. So it can be both. And I think in many ways, on some level, it needs to be both. And that's not a bad thing. And when you look at the statue of Teddy Roosevelt, which was put up in 1940, it's not, you know, it wasn't there when Columbus showed up in New York. It's, you know, it's 1940. It is a deeply offensive statue. And I say that as somebody whose family only showed up here in 1915, you know, and I don't know that it should be gotten rid of, but it's worth talking about and also understanding the changing of symbolic gestures actually do matter on a significant way. And, you know, Matt, you talked about, or Catherine might have talked about statues that make it into a presidential speech. In Tulsa, President Trump talked about how Italian Americans surrounded the statue in Columbus Circle so that nobody's going to fuck with that. What's funny about it is, you know, the whole fetishization of Columbus in America is absolutely directly related to Italian Americans flexing in the late 19th century and saying, we want somebody to represent an Italian American experience. And so they picked Columbus, who sailed for, you know, who existed long before modern Italy came into being and sailed for Spain. He became the icon of American of Italian Americans. And what is the most fascinating thing that happened in Columbus Circle? In 1971, a mafia don who had created a Italian American respect organization was shot and put into a coma by another gangster at Columbus Circle in the second Italian American Unity Day rally. These things get complicated very quickly, but the symbolism is meaningful, I think. And I love iconoclasm. I don't like literal iconoclasm where you see statues being pulled down and set on fire. That strikes me as a little too French Revolution for words. But we should be rotating in and out. Who are our Hall of Statues? Why does Kentucky have more statues of Jefferson Davis than the rest of the country combined? He was born there. Those statues came up in the late 1890s through the Brown versus Board of Education period because it was a way of reasserting a Southern culture that Southerners didn't even care about when Jefferson Davis left Kentucky and ultimately became head of the Confederacy.
To be clear, I am in no way opposed to removing Confederate statues. And, you know, a bunch of this, I think, is... my point is that you can get too caught up in the symbolism and not nearly enough focused on the practical changes. But certainly as far as the Confederate statues and place names and all of that go, I'm fine with getting rid of all of them tomorrow if that's what authorities want.
But here's the thing. I do think that even if we say, okay, listen, a statue of a Confederate put up, you know, in the 20th century explicitly to make a racist point, great. That statue sucks. Forget about it. But I'm a little troubled by the kind of erasure of history I think there is some, you know, so there are some people who are saying, mm-hmm. fine, take down the statues and put them in museums and put a plaque next to it explaining what's going on. Great. I think that's probably a good idea in some cases. But, you know, we were talking when Matt initially asked the question of, you know, what statue would you chain yourself to when they come for it, you know? And my first thought was, okay, the Statue of Liberty, liberty enlightening the world. That if you want to make a case, sure, that's problematic too. Everything's problematic. Like when they come for the Statue of Liberty, either because we don't welcome immigrants anymore, so we're going to have to take that thing down, or because it's colonialism or something, we're going to have to take that thing down. Like, I'm going to fight for that guy because statues are symbols of many things. And sometimes the good symbolism outweighs the bad. And I would say putting an angry mob in the position of being the arbiters of when the good outweighs the bad is not a great idea because you wind up pulling down Cervantes, for crying out loud.
I agree with that. But then, you know, going back to the Teddy Roosevelt statue, it's in front of the Natural History Museum in New York. Which was funded early on and in massive ways, not just by Teddy Roosevelt, but by people like Madison Grant, who was the premier scientific racist of his day. He was on the board of trustees. It's an institution now that has somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson as its most public face, the black astrophysicist. So, you know, the institution that is there is immensely complicated. And I agree, obviously, and completely with you guys that we should be talking about this stuff more and not reducing things. But it's also kind of easy to say, maybe Confederate statues put up in, I don't know, 1950, or the racist statue of Teddy Roosevelt with an Indian, and a black slave or a savage, you know, walking next to him, because of course he gets on horseback, that's put up in 1940. Yeah.
At least a little bit to you guys, like somebody said, guys, it's time to revise our corporate mission statement. And then this is like the like this is how the argument is playing out. And like, in some ways, it's sort of it's endless, right? Like your mission statement is on the one hand important; it guides and directs people, and you need to sort of have clarity on what it is you're all there to do together. On the other hand, the corporate mission statement meeting is not one that people generally look forward to.
Yeah, the Statue of Liberty changed from being liberty enlightening the world, which, you know, when it was sent over by France and it was a sign of the Enlightenment, to being the uber symbol of America as an immigrant country about 20 years later. So we're constantly changing both, not just the physical statues that are up, but the meanings of those. And I do think those conversations are worth having. And we are at a juncture where we're out of gas as a country, Peter. Don't you agree? I mean, like, we don't have a unified meaning anymore. People are contesting it. I think the 1619 Project has so many errors of fact and interpretation in it. It is bad as, you know, as an example, but that gesture is a good one. And we need to be, you know, we're coming out of a 20th century where we defined America primarily as a country of immigrants, of European immigrants, and as a Cold War power. And we're listing. We don't have a mission. And that mission doesn't need to be to, you know, invade foreign countries or anything like that, but it needs to be inclusive. And you know, so, I mean, I think part of what we're seeing here is actually a really positive development, that we are, you know, we're trying to hammer out what the meaning of the country is going to be. And hopefully we end in a good place rather than, you know, in a bunch of kind of semi-autonomous racial enclaves.
One complicating aspect to the Teddy Roosevelt statue in New York City, a lot of people have made the point, this isn't a mob pulling down the statue. This is a cultural institution making a decision that it's been talking about for a long time that's much different. That is true. It is also true that the statue was recently defaced and it's been under like 24-hour guard during this time. So I think that kind of pepped up their step. I want to go to a kind of a lightning round here of asking all of us to save one statue or monument or plaque that is under duress at the moment, remove one, and again, only if you want to on both cases, and also erect one that doesn't exist. I'll go first. The one that I would like to save is John Greenleaf Whittier. If you've ever been to Whittier, California, or heard of it, it is named after him, which is a very unusual thing for a Southern California city to be named after some East Coast swell. His statue was defaced recently. They, I think, spray painted BLM as well as expletive slave owners, as it was described in the newspaper article that I read about it in the, I think, the Whittier Daily News. He wasn't a slave owner. He was an abolitionist and a poet, and he edited anti-slavery newspapers. He helped establish the Liberty Party. He advocated for emancipation beginning at least in 1833. Don't screw with John Greenleaf Whittier, despite his unforgivable middle name. The one that I would remove is, I mean, come on. I can't name a specific one to remove as much as I want to remove the Stonewall Jackson's ridiculous porn horse statue in the Manassas National Cemetery. But it's also kind of amazing how big it is. But I would just say any federal government institution that has a Confederate general or whatever lionized and statuized, and that was put up like in 1940s or 50s, go ahead. You can take the worst of those down. That's my one. And as far as erecting a statue, obviously, Nick, the answer to that question is Bobby Gritch. We can put him up in Long Beach where he is from. Nick, you go next.
So the statues that I would protect is any statue of Roger Williams, the colonial American religious dissenter who founded both the city of Providence. On completely voluntary grounds, he bought property from the Indians in the area and worked to create the first place in America where your religious status as well as your racial status had no standing in public life. He's the best. There are a bunch of Roger Williams statues, even though there are no existing drawings of him or anything around the country. I think we should have more of those. And then the statue that I find I just want to call attention to is the statue in Huntsville, Texas, of Sam Houston, called A Tribute to Courage. Sam Houston was a originally from Tennessee, and he served as a senator from Tennessee, and I guess as a governor of Tennessee, something like that. But he lived with the Indians for a while and had an Indian wife for a while. Then he went to Texas, where he was the general in the Texas War of Independence from Mexico, which was largely fought in order to maintain slavery. Houston himself was a slave owner. He became the president of the Republic of Texas. He was the governor of Texas when it was seceding, and he refused to secede. He was a Jacksonian Unionist and refused to secede, wiped out his political career. And there is a 75-foot-tall statue of him in Huntsville, Texas, called A Tribute to Courage, where he is actually dressed like a businessman, because that's what he was when he was in Huntsville. And it is a it's a bizarre kind of Dadaist statue on the interstate that goes through Huntsville, Texas, where I lived for 2 years. It gets defaced on a regular basis.
Any ones you would like to erect that don't exist, Nick? Okay.
I don't believe in statues.
Like, you don't think they're real or
I've walked through a couple. No, but I actually this ties back to my love of Roger Williams. I believe that in a republic that there should be, let me put it this way, there should be no public statuary. I don't believe in the public sphere we should have tributes and things like that, because they call to mind imperial ambition and monarchy. This is very much the tradition that Roger Williams was actually coming out of. He was classmates at Cambridge with John Milton, and they had a radical dislike of public spectacle paid for by the taxpayer. I'm for getting rid of all of that.
Peter.
Like I said, I'm for tearing down any Confederate general monument pretty much anywhere. It's not a statue or even a monument, but a place name that is somewhat important, just a little bit to me, and that I would like to preserve is Crispus Attucks Park in Washington, D.C. It is basically a secret park. You wouldn't know it was there walking by it because it's hidden behind a block of row houses. It's entirely private, funded and run totally by the community. It's not far from where I live. Crispus Attucks was the first man to die in the American Revolution. He was the first man to die in the Boston Massacre. He was believed to be of both African and Native American descent. He died for the American Revolution. And now we have a little tiny private park near to my house that is just wonderful, that didn't shut down at all, even though a bunch of the parks in D.C. did. And then is named for somebody who deserves it and who was important to the American project.
And you want to erect anyone?
No, I'm not really a big statue guy.
God, anti-statues. Catherine, save us from these Philistines.
I'll start with the ones I want to put up since y'all are statue haters. I really enjoy what I think is a very 21st century relevant statue format, which is the human-sized or slightly larger than human-sized ground-level bronze statue. So I'm thinking here of, if you've ever been to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, they have this great room that's all the founders kind of arrayed in the room by their factions. And it's like, it means that you can go like snap a shot of yourself with George Mason or with the Anti-Federalists or whatever you want. These are like selfie-oriented statues, and I am here for it. I would say other examples of this genre are the large-ish Einstein on the National Mall, on the corner of the National Mall, the George Mason. Also, basically what I'm saying is I like statues of George Mason, I guess. There's a George Mason memorial tucked kind of weirdly into a swampy corner of the mall that you can like go sit on his lap if you're so inclined. I like statues of humans.
Are you trying to get them canceled?
No, I like statues of humans that are human-sized, because to try and make people 10 feet high is to ask too much of them, and we have seen the consequences of that. So more human-sized statues, even of potentially problematic founders. The statues that I would pull down are any statue I personally own and know others. And that's just me being an absolutely tiresome, garbage, property rights absolutist anarchist type. But here I am, your favorite garbage property rights.
Don't you own the government?
I sure don't, Matt. And that's a myth we should all fight. So yeah, I think like, here's something I might do. Go to my neighbor's house and be like, could you please take down your garden gnomes? They're hideous. And we could talk about that. And if my neighbor had...
Have you done that?
No, because I mind my own darn business. But since people seem to have such strong opinions about statues, it would be good if every statue was clearly owned by someone specifically, and that person could decide whether or not it should be up. And for statues that are in danger that I would defend, I am with Ronald Bailey in that I think if we are going to draw lines, that I am much more willing to stick up for allegorical or general statues that commemorate the war dead of any side, because I think that it is appropriate to mourn war dead. And so I think that includes statues for Confederate war dead. That's different than a general bestride a horse crushing a black person or whatever it is that we have out there. But I think in general, the Vietnam Memorial is a great example of a war memorial that focuses largely on the death toll of war. And that's not what memorial builders typically like to do, but it's what they should do. And some of the monuments to Confederate dead do the same thing. That is also a great Yale story, by the way, since the designer of that, of the Vietnam Memorial, famously got a C on the design when she submitted the project in her art and architecture, as part of her art and architecture curriculum at Yale. So good work, Yale.
Okay, let's go to our end of podcast. What have you been consuming in a cultural basis? Nick, why don't you go first?
I have been reading a book called The Price of Peace, which is by Zachary Carter, and it's about John Maynard Keynes and his conversion to the kind of macroeconomic figure that we have come to know and loathe on the libertarian or free market side of things. It's a really meticulously well-written and fascinating study of how Keynes's experience dealing with being part of the British government delegation that hammered out the Treaty of Versailles and war reparations changed his economic thinking and started getting him to move towards the idea that governments can and should be shaping large issues of macroeconomic demand and supply. It doesn't change my anxiety about kind of interventionist macroeconomics, but it fills in a lot of interesting detail about the sociology of economic thought. And one thing I've always been a little bit bothered by is that many people in the economics profession have no idea of the development of knowledge or the genealogy of knowledge in their field, which I think is always a failure.
I have finally watched Fleabag season 1 and 2, and I am not the first person on this podcast to recommend it, but I will just add my great enthusiasm for this show. Phoebe Waller-Bridge's dramedy of sex and singledom and the modern world. It's so incredibly engaging and pleasurable and enjoyable to watch because it has such a great, sharp view of the human condition. It's ironic and it's humane and hopeful and also really mean-spirited and cutting and kind of profoundly despairing at times, but without losing all hope or being simply snide. I really enjoyed it.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I'm going to be real. I've mostly just been watching random TikToks this week. It's been that kind of week. So I'm gonna recommend a specific trend on TikTok, which is individual people or small groups doing a cappella performances of a little ditty about crime rates in black neighborhoods. I first heard about it from TikTok users Alex Engelberg and Rin Starr. And so we will play it here, or I will link to it on the Reason Roundtable recommendations page, which I urge all y'all listeners to go check out. But it is essentially people singing about the bad statistics used by people who want to say, hey, what about black on black crime? Isn't that the real problem? And the lyrics includes things like white neighborhoods are under police, so of course they have lower rates of crime. And it's kind of great that this is a thing, that people are singing about the statistics of that are informing a major political debate in our country. Also very catchy and a little bit of an earworm. So TikTok on crime rates. I first saw this video from a TikTok creator called Joy Oladokun. And they're ridiculous and great.
I will, since Nick shockingly didn't take his slot to go okay boomer on us and talk about Bob Dylan's new record, which I have been enjoying so far, though I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet. But I will slide in some okay boomer stuff by saying, weirdly enough, I'd never seen the movie A Hard Day's Night, even though Beatles fan from way back. And, you know, a lot of it filters into your consciousness, but we watched it for family night. And I really highly recommend it, including for people who are not at all super big Beatles fans. It's not required. It was very funny to watch it with my wife, who was like, there's no plot here. Nothing's happened. I don't understand. And also, she was very irritated at how rude the boys were to their elders and things like that. Different generations now looking back at it, it's pretty interesting. And then, you know, I have one Beatle fan kid and one Beatle hater kid, but they both converged on falling in love with Paul, which is interesting, if not quite surprising. But for those who haven't seen it, it feels like the last black and white movie. It feels like a black and white movie that's about ready to burst into color. It's amazingly fresh. A jolt of energy. You will see and recognize. It's like watching, if you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time now, you will say, oh, that explains that scene in this other movie. You have that sensation. Or if you read On the Road right now, you know, that explains all these other books. It explains MTV, explains a lot of editing, explains a lot of things. But most importantly, my God, those guys are pretty charismatic and funny. And they had great slang, just absolutely great slang, and like no female characters. And it fails all tests and everything else. But it's a super hoot to watch. Watch it intergenerationally. It's fun. It's great. The end. Okay, that's all the time we have for here. Going to stick to that noon landing, Nick Gillespie. Go and listen to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcast. And we will be seeing you next week, even though I will not, because I will be on vacation. Goodbye forever.